Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Super excited today. I am joined by someone I've wanted to speak to for a long time, Dr. Robert Sutton from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He is a pediatric intensivist and a cardiac arrest researcher. He does work both in the lab and clinically, and he's put out a lot of the stuff on hemodynamically directed CPR, on advanced resuscitation techniques. And the reason I chose now to speak to him is I saw a slide from his talk at the Society of Critical Care Medicine on what cardiac arrest treatment's going to look like in 2025. But my take is this slide is actually how cardiac arrest should work at advanced centers in 2018. So a lot of this will not make sense unless you actually see that slide. So you could go over to the show notes, mcrit.org/228, and take a look. And then listen to this podcast, because if you want cutting-edge critical care for cardiac arrest patients, this is it. All right, so then let's jump right in. So looking at this diagram, the first question that gets asked is there an arterial line and is there a central line for CVP? And we will pretend there is not. And this was the first question I had for you. It says place these in the femoral vessels. Now, we've been placing our art lines in the femart for all our cardiac arrests for about, 9 or 10 years now. We haven't been placing CVP lines. And when I look at this, I ask, wow, can I place a CVP line in the femoral vessels? We never do that in standard critical care. Is this a different situation during cardiac arrest?
When you actually look at the pressure differences on a supine patient, they're not that different. And what are we really looking for here, right? We're looking for a trend. If it's 5 or 7, do I really care? But if it's 25, that might be a different story. And so we're really looking for trends and responses in all of our numbers. And so while the number may not be 100% perfect, if you throw it in the groin, you're still getting the number. And it's interesting what I thought you were going to ask me, because when I think it was 2 resuscitation science symposiums ago, I talked about this protocol when it was a little bit kind of more naive. And what actually the adults were worried about is what happens if you throw it in a groin vessel and it's not the artery, but that you put it in the vein and then you're guiding your CPR by a venous pressure. And it's very interesting to see how with the use of ultrasound over the last, 5 to whatever years, that has become like, that wasn't what you were worried about. You're saying you put them in the groin all the time. Now that's kind of becoming the standard practice that we can just get an art line in the adults specifically.
Well, let's go off on that tangent for 2 seconds, because it's one that's been really just driving me crazy for a few years now. So, I'm ECMO fellowship trained. I actually went to my new center solely to start an ECPR program. And if you had to ask me what is the most difficult part about ECPR, it is actually knowing which vessel you're in, unless you actually see the needle tip touching the vessel. Because, and we're actually, we're doing a little bit of a study on this now. We're taking a bunch of our arrest patients who we managed to get both vessels cannulated and looking at any differences between them. There's no color difference in almost all of them. There's no pressure difference during CPR in almost all of them. They just gravitate towards the same number. And that's even with actual, transduction, not just looking at it. I'm at a loss for anything except whether you saw it actually go in real time or throwing wires up there and getting an abdominal x-ray to see the wires diverge. So Dr. Sutton stated he's in the same boat. If anyone out there has ideas on how to differentiate these vessels during cannulation or placement of these lines, please put it in the comments. I am desperate. This is a big area of fraught practice. All right, so we are now placing those lines based on your diagram. And in those first 2 minutes, while we're trying to get those lines in, you have do standard ACLS, makes sense. High quality CPR, we'll talk about that. Shock if VF, give epi, draw an ABG. Let's talk about this one. So you're having ABGs every 6 minutes. What are you looking for on there?
So a lot of that is getting to, I am also someone that reviews cases, and you can imagine one of the things medical legally that everybody focuses on in cardiac arrest is, did you look for reversible causes? And I can't tell you how many times I've reviewed cases where, 20 minutes of CPR and not one sampling of a blood gas to look for, was there anything they could have done differently, a glucose, a potassium, a calcium, anything. And we know about, the haphazard administration of bicarb and calcium that is panned out in the pediatric literature. Some of it is to find stuff you can fix. And really, it kind of fits in too, as well, to go into the bottom right side, which is when you're starting to talk about ventilation. So one of the things that I'm looking at right now in a multi-center trial is I am trying to, quote, disprove the dogma that in kids in particular, who more often arrest from respiratory causes and who have more compliant chests, that when I have a kid who's on an oscillator and they arrest, mean airway pressure of 30, and I got them on an oscillator because I can't ventilate them on a conventional ventilator, but yet when their heart stops, I put them on a rate of 10 and minimal PEEP. Mm. How on earth can I think that that is supposed to work for that child from a lung compliance standpoint, from a PVR standpoint, with letting the lungs completely collapse down during CPR? And so what I'm really getting that in is not only is it reversible causes, but it's also to know, hey, if my hemodynamic targets are met, maybe I want to up the rate a little bit, see if I can blow off some CO2. Because if I can get the pH above 7.2, I'm probably much more likely to have that heart restart.
Fascinating. And let's put a pin in that, because I definitely want to talk a little bit more about ART and venous pH. So I am writing that down to bring back. Okay, so that makes sense. Now, you'll note on there the box for NIRS or brain oximetry. We talked a little bit about that, but both of us agree at this point, it's useful information for the research side. We don't quite know how to use it clinically yet, so I'm not going to talk about it on this podcast. All right, super cool. Let's keep going through. So now we get to a line that says assess hemodynamic goals. And this is going to relate to our both CVP and our diastolic, and the nice thing that you've added here that I really want to talk about is both diastolic and systolic blood pressure. So let's go through them one by one. So we'll start, the top of your diagram is the CVP. And we, like I said, we've only been doing the ART line. We haven't been doing this. So you have a set of interventions for each level. So if your CVP is less than 10, you have them adding an impedance threshold device and giving a rapid fluid bolus. Why don't you talk about those two?
So we don't have, this is more of, you know, this was designed to be kind of 2025 guidelines. So we don't have a lot of data to support that. I'll say that up front. But the idea here is if you have a CVP in and you think your volume down based on a lower CVP, which we use a lot in pediatrics, maybe try to fix that either by improving venous return or giving fluid. We experimented with this a little bit in a paper that was published in the Blue Journal. Ryan Morgan was the first author in a sepsis model. Ultimately, fluid alone was not enough to save these animals. So we tried our standard hemodynamic-directed CPR plus fluids. They still all died. And what we actually had to add in, and it's in there as well in that this algorithm, was we actually had to add a pulmonary vasodilator. Because what we were actually running into was it wasn't just being fluid down. We had a resistor in the pulmonary circuit from the LPS and sepsis.
All right. That's fascinating, because we did this experiment on a city level. The New York City Fire Department decided to do a pre-hospital hypothermia study where they were giving 2 liters of fluid to every single cardiac arrest in the field for chill. And I shouldn't say every single one, but a huge proportion of these patients went into florid, like pouring out of the endotracheal tube pulmonary edema. And so, I think you need to add something to that fluids to actually keep it all from just churning into the right heart and not going anywhere.
And it would be curious to know is if you actually were able to do some kind of volume assessment on those patients, you know, where were they prior to getting the 2 liters? Because there may have been a subset, which is the idea of why take a look before you do it. Maybe there's a subset who are volume down. And in kids, it's very common that it's progressive hypotension and shock, and fluids is, you know, the answer a lot of the times, which is why we put that box in there and that, quote, PEDS algorithm.
That makes sense. Now, the ITD was only shown to be beneficial when in conjunction with active compression decompression CPR with that one Lancet trial. I know this is 2025, but let's try to make this physiologic HCA 2018. Would you say people should be using the ITD at this point with the evidence we have?
The way that I would put this in is if you are in the situation where you are not meeting hemodynamic goals, I think it's reasonable to use it across all age categories.
All right, perfect. All right, so CVP 10 to 20, that's normal range. We just leave them alone. CVP greater than 20, consider early echocardiogram. And what are you looking for there?
So we're looking for stuff that could raise your intrathoracic pressure there, right? So do you got a big pneumothorax that's actually increasing? Do you have a pulmonary embolus? So we published a series here at CHOP, an amazing amount of adolescents that rested at our institution, like percentage-wise. Again, it's a biased sample because we were looking for it. But I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but they a lot of them had pulmonary embolus.
So now we get to the actual blood pressure. So we start off with diastolic. Now you have here diastolic less than 30. And I have two questions about that. I've used 40. I think the one human trial on it was actually coronary perfusion pressure based, but the extrapolation of that was somewhere around 35 to 40. So I want to know where the 30 came from. And then if you have a CBP, why not use coronary perfusion rather than the diastolic blood pressure?
I think you would say that you would use coronary perfusion pressure if you could, because obviously it figures into the data points that you want, right? The problem is getting that on a monitor a lot of the times. And so, it's kind of like, to me, it's like version 1.0 getting to version 2.0. If I can just get people to look up at the monitor for the diastolic pressure, I think we've made a big win. And then version 2.0 is saying, all right, now let's figure out how to get this up on the monitor where it actually subtracts the continuous CVP tracing, which is exactly what we do in the lab. And move down the line. The reason why we picked diastolic pressure is because a study that Bob Berg, myself, and the Capcorn Network, which is an NICHD-funded network, 7 institutions, some of the bigger names like Pittsburgh, Children's National, UCLA, UCSF, Colorado, Nationwide. So you recognize some of those pediatric hospitals. But that network actually sent us de-identified waveforms, which we then extracted the blood pressures off of them in 162 or 167 kids. And the optimal diastolic blood pressure in that sample was 34 millimeters of mercury in the older kids. And that did include some kind of older kids and adolescents. But we had to, the network itself is supported by the University of Utah Data Coordinating Center. And like good statisticians, they said, all right, guys, you got to pick some targets here, a priori of what you think the right answer is. So we're not just playing with this data. And, we kind of looked what normal kids' blood pressures are, those types of things. What could we possibly expect? Again, pulling in some of the information that you're talking about with coronary perfusion pressures of 20 in the Paradis articles. So we decided that in infants, we couldn't pick 40. We that just seemed really high because some of these kids have a systolic of 40 and that's fine. So we went with 25 and we went with 30 for the older children greater than 1. And that included the adolescents. So those were our a priori cut points. They were associated with a near doubling of survival and survival with good neuro in this cohort. And then when we did a spline analysis to try to find an optimal cut point, like when the survival kind of leveled off, it was around 34 millimeters of mercury.
That's perfect. And this might be one of those situations where it's a little bit higher in adults than you're going to find.
Agreed. And it's interesting that you bring up the higher target because that's one of the things that we're investigating in our lab right now. And they have done this in the past too, is there a threshold that by trying, it seems like targeting blood pressure is probably better than just kind of standard same care for everyone. But is there a limit that, you start losing autoregulation and you start really driving up the pressure to the brain? And so some of those higher targets is some of our interest from a research standpoint to actually look at.
All right. Now, what you're going to do if the diastolic is lower than whatever level we set is you're going to go to epi up to Q1 minute. You're going to consider an epi infusion, which when you think about it, if you're doing epi Q1 minute, the infusion's like a drop in the bucket unless you're using far beyond our pressor or inotrope doses we'd use in the unit. So let's talk about that. And then vasopressin. So let's start off with the epi infusion. Why that drug in the background and what doses are you talking about there?
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I wish I had this study off the top of my head, but Bob Newmar actually in that same session presented this data. And so what you're really looking at, these are type of higher doses. When we do it here at CHOP, we're giving a code dose every 10 minutes. So it's just to give a basal amount. So it's a mic per kilo per minute. You get 10 mics per kilo every 10 minutes. And we do that to give the basal amount so that what we're doing is this is kind of there. And in rather having this, we have this. So there's a little bit of a basal that kind of keeps running in the background. And I don't think that there's ever been a survival benefit shown with that. But what we think is you're going to get better, basically pharmacokinetics and those types of things and a more stable level. What I've always struggled with is once you get the patient back, what do you do then? Because you were just on an epi, you know, and kids run an epi of one, do you cut it back to 0.1 or 0.2, which would be normal dosing, or do you leave it there? If you don't cut it back fast enough and they have a hypertensive burst, is that detrimental in and of itself? Which is why that is one of the things I think actually needs some pediatric study to figure out if it's really something we should be adding.
Now, epi's always confused me, and I understand why the research is not going to be done on a large level until we actually prove epi works. But norepi seems to make a lot of sense compared to epi, because we don't want the beta. The beta's seemingly purely deleterious, and we have an agent that hits both alpha-1 and alpha-2 that has a lot less beta stimulation. It just seems like epi is a weird thing to go. And for that reason, we've started the norepi infusions as our basal. And it seems to me that if paramedic 2 comes out positive, the next step is to compare epi to norepi. What do you think about that?
One option, and then what you're going to get to on the next thing, what I think is we should actually be looking at is vasopressin as a rescue drug. And I am not as up on the adult literature as much when it comes to epi versus norepi and that type of comparison. But when it comes to the kids, our lab, that's actually the hemodynamic directed protocol. And we've actually gotten criticized by this by some of the reviewers who said, you're not really doing hemodynamic directed CPR, you're doing vasopressin rescue. So our protocol is actually epi-epi-vaso. And the idea here is if you've given two doses of epinephrine and you've given it pretty frequently at a minute interval and it's not working, giving it a third time is the definition of insanity. So try something else. And you've probably already got enough beta on board because you just gave two doses of epi. So let's hit a different receptor with a little longer half-life. And so this is the protocol that we came up with. And of course, you know that there's the VSE trials in adults. So we got some criticism. Well, maybe you were just doing vasopressin rescue. And so what we're actually trying to rally some troops in pediatric hospitals here is to see if there's equipoise to maybe do a trial of vasopressin rescue in kids. And if you give one dose of epi, when you reach for that second dose, maybe we try something different if it didn't work. And that would be truly applicable for kids because of a lot of this is progressive hypotension and progressive shock. And so we're really looking where a lot of the kid arrests are having diastolic hypotension where vasopressin would be the right drug.
You know, well, the whole thing is baffling because first of all, we have two RCTs on vasopressin plus epi. No RCTs that show epi benefit, and they've actually taken it out of the protocol. We used to have vasopressin in our code cart. It's a drudgery to get it during an arrest. Now they've taken it out because the AHA took it out, and it's the only drug we actually had, not great evidence, but I've heard people say, oh, it was done in Greece, so we can't believe that. And it's just like, how close-minded do you have to be? We have nothing better than this, and yet people totally disregard it. And I think those researchers made a slight error by adding the steroids to the mix before they established it without, because then everyone's like, oh, it's another steroid study, throw that in the trash. But yeah, it makes complete sense.
I agree with you.
So I'm baffled.
You know, some of the arguments that I have heard is all about the control group and really lower survival. And so if you're really bad, trying anything would have worked. You know, I hear a lot of the arguments, but it is one of the reasons why to get to your other point of they've taken it out of everything. Of course, you know, as the guy that does that here at CHOP, we did the same thing. But because it is probably the accepted vasopressor in pulmonary hypertension crises, we were able to get it put in all of the Pyxis machines throughout the ICUs, as well as we kind of have a go bag or a response bag that the code team goes with and has all of our drugs in it, just in case we're in what I call a hostile area without a code cart. And so we always have vasopressin as well as isopril, even though it's $1 billion, available to us through our stat packs for these very reasons.
Now, this box brings up one of my pet peeves in cardiac arrest. And I talked about this at the SMAC conference with some of the major researchers in cardiac arrest. No one has an answer for me. But, you know, we talk about these subtypes of arrest, and we've split it mostly into rhythms. But I've noticed the subtype in my practice, and like I said, we've been doing invasive monitoring on these for almost a decade now, of just intractable vasoplegia. And it's patients with a systolic of 120. We're using mechanical CPR devices. They get amazing systolics and diastolics of 7 or 8. And I'm giving the epi at far greater frequency, just as you alluded to. I cannot get these patients to get their diastolic up. And based on everything I know, there's no way I'm bringing them back until I do. Have you encountered this in kids? And what do you do? Is there anything beyond these three items in the box that you have to offer?
No, that's when think about switching to a different vasopressor. And if that's still not working, which is why very quickly after you've done 3 cycles, we're activating the ECMO team. And granted, if it's shock, we may have issues with, you know, high output and inability to even run them on pumps. But the only way that that child's going to make it, if you can get the diastolic up, is through extracorporeal support. And so thinking about that early is the way to save that child or adult.
And now, anecdotally, and I don't have great evidence for this, even when these guys went on pump, they don't make it because that intractable vasoplegia continues. I mean, we do the same thing. We're like, this is the last resort. I wonder, and no one's done the data on this yet, but I think people are actively looking at it. Reboa, I don't know if that's in any way touched the peds world such that you'd even know what the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah, but, no, what is that?
All right. So it's a retrograde balloon up the aorta.
Oh, okay.
And they're actually now viable. They're, you know, when we learned to do this initially, it was a ridiculous Coda catheter. It was enormous. But now they actually have one that's 7 French. It's super easy to do if you could get an art line. And you're actually just placing a balloon in the aorta right below the xiphoid. That would seem to be one solution here. But I was going to ask if you had any thoughts about it, but I don't think you've explored because it hasn't hit the peds world. There's no peds.
No, it hasn't. It definitely has not hit the peds world. But physiologically, again, going back to the kind of the basic concepts we're talking about here, that would make sense, right? I mean, that's what's going to fix the diastolic pressure, get the coronary perfusion pressure up, and maybe get the arch start.
My friend Jim Manning, I don't know if you're familiar with any of his stuff. He has a lab in North Carolina. He's been doing the work on SAP, selective aortic arch perfusion. He's actually giving his vasopressors into the aorta directly through a similar catheter that's placed, you know, just after the arch. And that's in, he's got a pig lab as well, has had remarkable effects on that vasoplegia.
Interesting.
Okay. So yeah, we don't currently have a solution for these intractable vasoplegia patients. I was hoping that would have come out of this interview as you have the magic bullet, but no. Okay.
The magic bullet is get your ECMO teams on the roll.
There you go. All right. So now systolic blood pressure. And if that's less than 100, you have 3 items here as well. Increase your compression depth and rate. And I'm super curious about the rate part of it. Consider epi if you're not already doing it for diastolic. And then, again, enter the echocardiogram box. All right, why don't you talk a little bit about this box?
So the echocardiogram box is actually out of some of the work of Felipe Turan.
Yeah, who, good friend of mine.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you guys know each other. He and I have met, and we're talking about this and actually trying to kind of recruit him over to our lab because we have totally bought into what he's been telling us and think that hand position might actually be one of the ways through echo to improve the impulse and actually get a better systolic pressure on the ejection. So that's really where we're getting at with the echocardiogram, that's probably something that we should be doing. And then changing up your depth and rate. I mean, that, as you know, there's a lot of good data that shows that higher depths improve your pressures. That's pretty standard. So you just need to push a little deeper. But then, you know, the other part of that is I am personally a little worried about the kind of it's 120 and you can't go any faster than that. And I hear all the arguments. I've even published some of the papers that have shown the inverse relationship between depth and rate, that if you try to push too fast, you're just going to shallow out your compressions. But if I've got a hemodynamic monitor in, is it worth just trying to push another 10 or 20 per minute and seeing if the systolic blood pressure gets better or if things improve? I think the answer is yes. If I have the monitor and I'm using the feedback, am I recommending a rate of 160 for everybody? Absolutely not. What I'm saying is if I'm doing what we start with and it's not working, maybe try a little faster. And as you know, there was one study that actually came out much smaller than the stuff that came out of the ROC consortium, kind of establishing that upper rate limit, that showed that actually a little faster was better in a smaller but still large compared to pediatrics. So we actually have a paper right now under review that I hope will be hitting the literature pretty soon that will support some of my personal biases that faster rates might not necessarily be all that bad, but that's about all I can say about that.
All right. That's fascinating. We'll look out for that. All right. Let's go into the next cycle box. And here we're assessing ventilation and oxygenation based on our blood gases. And you've already mentioned this is an arterial blood gas. I guess before we even go into this, I've noticed, and it's been in the literature, I mean, these stuff came out of the 70s or 80s, that in some patients, there is a near perfect arterial blood gas and a dismal venous blood gas. And in fact, in some cases, they are hypocapnic on the arterial side and profoundly hypercapnic on the venous side. So you've chosen the arterial blood gas. Some would say the venous better represents the actual physiologic milieu. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I think it's part of the problem there, right? The physiology of that, though, is about venous pulling and not getting it through, right? And so you kind of just sit and pull there. One of the reasons why we've picked that side is we were really looking for not necessarily the PCO2, but the oxygenation. And, you know, we get into this a lot. And actually, right now in my the multicenter trial that I'm running, we went through some of this. Should we, like, what blood gases should we take? And they're... sometimes they're not actually all that different from what we were looking during CPR, although what you said is 100% true. And so what we decided to do is just get them all and try to really answer that question and do the comparisons on the venous and the arterial side during actual children, during actual arrests. And we've got about 500 kids in this trial right now. So we're really hoping that I can give you a more educated answer of what the right blood gas is. The reason why I picked arterial was mostly because I was focusing on kind of oxygen titration with that box. And that was kind of the point of that, as well as using the non-invasive monitors, hopefully down the line, to be able to help us to start titrating oxygen.
All right. That makes complete sense. So in that case, we'll do that second line first. So if your NIRS is greater than 50 and your PaO2 on that arterial gas is greater than 200, consider a reduction. You have here FiO2 down to 50%. And then I imagine you're going to wait till that next ABG and make sure you didn't go too far. All right, that makes complete sense.
And we actually are about to put in a large animal trial for evaluation by reviewers that did exactly that.
Super cool.
So there should be some evidence behind some of that of why that might make sense.
I got a question from one of my listeners that fits in nicely here. Have you noticed anything we could take prognostically or clinically from a pulse ox number and waveform during cardiac arrest? You know, sometimes we see it, especially in the mechanical CPR, and they have a waveform and their sats are 98%. And that, I don't know what to do with it, but it certainly makes me feel better when I can't even get a waveform or that waveform is there and it's like 30%. Have you explored this at all?
It's actually probably, it's funny, I didn't put this plant out there of your listener, but that is literally my number one research interest right now.
Ooh.
And I, like you and everybody else who's at the bedside, when they see the pulse ox pick up, irrespective of what the number is, because, well, you can't trust the number because you're doing CPR. Well, you can trust the pulsatility. That thing picked that up. And I always tell people when they're feeling for pulses and you have a pulse ox, stop feeling for a pulse. You have a pulse. It's called a pulse ox for a reason. And, you know, everyone rolls their eyes at me. But yes, when it picks up pulsatility, it makes us all feel good. Do we have any idea when it has pulsatility what the average blood pressure is on our patients in during cardiac arrest? No. Are those numbers clinically correlated with measures of CPR quality? We don't know. But the answer is they are in animals. And so there's a couple papers out there. One was in PLOS One, where they've actually looked at the area under the curve as well as the amplitude of the pulse oximeter, and found that it was highly correlated with coronary perfusion pressure, as well as when they looked at kind of low quality CPR and high quality CPR, those numbers were very different between the groups, just like coronary perfusion pressure was, just like end-tidal CO2 was. So it was on par with some of the physiologic monitors that we use. And then another group did something very interesting, which is actually what I'm more interested in, is you're doing CPR, and whether or not the pulse ox is showing you anything, the patient starts to get a rate under there, that pulsatility will be picked up by the pulse ox way before we pick it up. And wouldn't it be nice if the pulse ox said, hey, there might be an underlying rhythm under there. I'm picking up another rate that's coming through on top of your CPR rate. So you can actually do an FFT on the pulse ox signals and actually find underlying frequencies. And so that is actually one of our big research interests right now, is to really you know, collect a bunch of pulse ox data on kids during CPR, collected with arterial blood pressures and end-tidal CO2, and actually put it to the test. And the problem with it is when we don't have the signal, is that just because the pulse ox is on the bed or because things stink? So we're going to have to try to overcome that with this. But yes, I do actually think that if we could get the studies out there, pulse ox will ultimately be one of the indicators that we use in our whole protocol.
Fantastic. Perfect. All right, let's talk about that last piece then of that box, which I think is the last piece of this algorithm, which is the ventilation, the CO2 side. And so you have down here, if the pH is less than 7.2 and the PaCO2 is greater than 70, consider increasing your ventilatory rate. Now, wow, this one is rife with potential stuff going on here, because we know that in cardiac arrest patients, there's not just a ventilatory consequence, there's potentially a hemodynamic consequence from respiratory rate. Why don't you talk a little bit about this?
So as you see, I preface that with, if hemodynamic goals are met.
Fair enough.
You know, it's kind of like one of those things. So I had an old cardiologist teach me that acid meets don't beat. And if you have a pH below 7.2, the heart's not happy. I don't understand. I don't think it's a step to then say, if my pH is 7.1, it's going to be hard to restart that heart, irrespective of what I'm doing. So if I have my hemodynamic goals met, which again, I'm making a jump from pressure to flow, I am assuming I have good pulmonary blood flow. Why not titrate it up a little bit? If it hurts the hemodynamics, back off. But if I can blow off just a little bit more CO2 and improve my pH, I think I will improve my patient's chance.
All right. It's reasonable. And I'd love to see data, because I'm on the same page as you. I think we have room. I think most of the deleterious effects come when you have a 60 per minute or 120 per minute, which I've witnessed not infrequently.
Oh, it's crazy. Yep.
But to go from 8 to 15 or 16 does not seem to be a huge jump.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I think the rate that was published in the original Ofterheide articles that really pushed a lot of this, that upper category was 30. And I think the reason, you know, one of the reasons we've pushed on this to kind of keep it down around 10 is it is rampant how fast we ventilate people. And even telling someone to get to 10, we're still in large registry data doing 20, 30. I mean, it's really a hard thing to do.
Fair enough. All right. And then the last piece on that is, and we had mentioned we'd come back earlier in the show, is the bicarbonate administration during cardiac arrest and where you stand on that. And if you give it, are you increasing your respiratory rate?
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. And I'm speaking of the literature that is out there that, in my opinion, unfortunately, is horrifically confounded by indication, particularly in pediatrics. Willy-nilly bicarb is associated, as we call it, willy-nilly bicarb is associated with worse outcomes. So it's kind of why I have built in get a blood gas early, because I do think, going back to low pH, harder to restart the heart, that if I can document that problem early, I think I am well within my rights to give a dose of sodium bicarbonate. And if monitoring those things that you're talking about, like, am I worried about an increase in CO2 rise? Should I increase my rate of those things? Again, we don't necessarily do that here, but it would fit within my logic that I told you about, that if I give it, my hemodynamic goals are met and my end tidal jump and I don't have ROS, of course, let's increase by, you know, 4 or 5 breaths per minute and try to blow that off.
All right. This has been such a great pleasure. This conversation has been amazing.
No, this was great. I just want to thank you for having me. And if anybody has any specific questions, wants to email me, my email is my last name, Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N, R as in Robert, and that's at chop.edu, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.edu. Feel free to email me. I'm very accessible.
Well, there you go. An amazing interview. Brought up a lot of things to think about. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Go to mcrit.org/228. Find the slide there and put your comments, and I'll talk to you soon. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.